Overview of the Book of Romans, Part 1, the third talk in a series on Romans, was presented by Jack Crabtree on April 26, 2009, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2009. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Okay, we're going to last week I tried to orient you to the Book of Romans and why it was written, who wrote it, and from where he wrote it. What I'd like to do in the next few weeks, a couple weeks or so, is deal with looking at an overview of the Book of Romans. After we have the overview, if I'm right in my overview, then you understand Romans. But what I want to do is sort of give an overview of the argument, and then we'll go back and look at the particular details of the text, paragraph by paragraph, and go through the book that way. But I think you never understand the details of a biblical text until you understand what it is, what it's saying, and then you can go in and look and see how it's saying that in the details. So that's the way I'm going to proceed. We'll spend most of our time on the first section of portion one today of the letter. Now, I'm speaking about my translation, which if you don't have it, you can get it on our website online. Check with me about how, well, don't check with me about how to do it. Check with Robbie about how to do that. And I knew this would happen, but in looking at portion one, I've divided the parts and the paragraphs a little bit differently, so I'll be coming out with a version B here shortly that will go on the website. I will try to give you both references as we go through here today, but if I forget, the reason it's confusing is because I'm jumping back and forth between the paragraph marks and part marks for two different versions. The question is, what's the overall purpose of this letter? I'm going to argue that the overall purpose of this letter is to fortify these Gentile believers who are receiving against the questions, the challenges, and the false teachings that will follow in the wake of Jews returning to Rome. So you remember last week I argued that the occasion upon which we find this letter written is Paul is sending this letter back with a group of Jews who've been exiled from Rome by the edict of Claudius. They've been kicked out of Rome. They have spent the last 5 to 7 years of their life living in various other parts of the Roman Empire, and this particular group probably in Corinth, and that's where Paul knows them. Claudius has died. The edict is rescinded. They can return to their original home in Rome, have chosen to do so, and Paul is sending this letter back with them to the Gentiles who had been left behind in the church, the Gentile believers in Rome, and he's sending this letter back to them. That's a very different scenario than has informed my thinking about Romans for most of my life. Most of my life, I just had this vague sense that Paul was in the eastern part of the empire, and he heard rumors that there was a church in Rome. And he thought, I didn't start that church. Maybe I better tell them what I teach. And he wrote this letter to tell this anonymous group of Gentiles that he hears tell are in Rome what the gospel is. Now, under that scenario, it would make sense that he's writing a kind of exhaustive, complete, total, systematic presentation of his gospel. But what I'm arguing now is that that's not what prompted him to write it. He knows that they know the gospel. They're believers. They've responded to something. In fact, he's going to use some language about halfway through the letter where he said, you became obedient to that outline of that teaching that you received. They have the broad outlines of the gospel. They know what it is. He doesn't need to tell them that because that's what it is they're believing that makes them a church, that makes them believers. So he doesn't need to do that. But he knows that there is something that he does need to do, especially in view of the fact that there's a whole bunch of Jews going back into Rome. He knows that everywhere he's gone in the Roman Empire, whenever he starts proclaiming the gospel, a riot breaks out, a riot by the Jews. There's a lot of hostility in the Jewish community to this gospel that he preaches. He also knows that everywhere he goes, he has in his wake a bunch of believers who are a bunch of Jews who claim to be connected to Jesus, who come along and say, Paul's got it all wrong. Jesus didn't teach what Paul said he taught. He taught something else. Let us set you straight about what it is that Jesus taught. And following his wake are a group of people who believe the same gospel that Paul believes, but they're absolutely adamant that no Gentile can be saved through Jesus unless they live like a Jew. Circumcise, eat, keep the Sabbath, and keep kosher in their eating. So Paul knows that all three of those things are going to be problems. So my contention is the overall purpose of the letter is to address, it is to examine the gospel and its implications in such a way that the Gentiles are equipped and fortified to be able to resist the seductive lies and hostile challenges of that impact of Judaism that comes back into the Roman community. So let's briefly examine those three things that he has to address. And this explains something about the letter that I've never really quite understood before. Is it's very tempting to want to target or to see who Paul is targeting. What exact perspective is he trying to address? Well, he's actually trying to address all three, I think. He doesn't know which is the problem yet because it hasn't become a problem yet. But he knows that all three of those things are potentially a problem. So he's exploring the gospel in such a way that he fortifies the Gentiles against any one of them that might become the most compelling to them. Why do riots ensue? Well, riots ensue because the unbelieving Jews see Paul as basically dissing their ancestral religion. He's coming along and saying it's not about the Mosaic Covenant, it's about Jesus. And they see that as such a radically different and alien kind of set of ideas that it's as if Paul is attacking the very foundations of everything that they believe and have believed for centuries. And understandably, given their emotional commitment to that, they react to that. So part of what Paul is arguing in the letter is trying to help the Gentiles see, on the one hand, why he's not attacking their ancestral religion in the way that they think that he is, on the one hand. On the other hand, yes, he is offering a radically different alternative to their way of understanding their ancestral religion. He is doing that, and he's going to make the case for why that makes sense. So with respect to the unbelieving Jews, he's going to clarify the gospel in that respect. There are other rabbis or other Jews that are coming along and saying, yeah, Jesus was a great rabbi, but what did Jesus teach us? Jesus taught us to be obedient to the law, and to conform our lives to its demands and its requirements. Another group of people is coming along and saying, Paul's right, Jesus was the Messiah, he came, he died for our sins, he was raised for the forgiveness of our sins. All that stuff that the apostles teach you is true, that's absolutely right. But you cannot be a disciple of Jesus if you do not live your lives in obedience to God. And what better way to live your life in obedience to God than to obey the Mosaic Covenant? Why would he have given us the Mosaic Covenant if he didn't expect us to obey it? Very reasonable. So they are proposing that we need to live anyone who's going to be pleasing to God, and a bona fide, genuine, authentic disciple of Jesus is going to have to also live a life of obedience to the law. What all three groups have in common is that all of them are saying, the bottom line of what all of them are saying is you can't be saved unless you live like a Jew. All of them have that in the foundations of what they're teaching. So Paul's overall purpose in this letter, I'm going to argue, is to give his Gentile readers the insight and the perspective from which to resist the idea that they need to begin to live like Jews, and that if they don't live like Jews, that there really is no salvation for them. So it's not his purpose to kind of systematically explain, articulate, describe, and defend the gospel by taking it from the top. Let's go from A to Z, and let me just trace through all the ideas and concepts and explain the gospel to you. That's not what he's doing. That explains why in the first portion of the letter, and this was always sort of puzzling to me, in the first portion of the letter, he deals with the gospel itself extremely succinctly in chapter 3. After 2.5 chapters, basically 2.5 chapters of preliminary stuff, he finally gets around to the gospel and he says, well, you know, this stuff. Very briefly, very succinctly, very fluidly, as he lays it out there in order to pass on past it. That's not the way you would write a letter if the whole point was to articulate, describe, defend, and clarify exactly what the gospel is. You would unpack, you would analyze, you would describe in detail, you would explain in detail, you would explain what a propitiation is, you would explain what justification is. All those things that we wrestle with, he would be explaining if that were his goal, if that were his agenda. But he's assuming that we're cued in to those things. What he doesn't think that his Gentile readers are altogether cued in to are the implications of that. And what fully lies behind that, such that they can understand there is no reason for a Gentile to become a Jew in order to be saved in Jesus. That's the key. Okay, backing up then, what's the overall structure or outline of the letter? I know when I was first taught it, they told me that chapter 1 through 5 was about justification. Chapter 6 and 7 is about sanctification. Chapter 8 is about glorification. And by then, we stop teaching it and we never get around to the rest, so who cares? Each teacher, in my experience, sort of proposes their own structure for how to understand the letter. But if you look at it carefully, the structure is not really an attempt to get the author's intent out of the book. How was he thinking? How was he structuring it? Why was he saying what he was saying when he was saying it? It's mostly offered by a Bible teacher to meet the needs of organizing his preaching and sermonizing. It's not really exegetical. It's expository in its scope and its nature. So what I want to do over the next several weeks is try to explain what I understand to be the structure of the letter, and hopefully I'm not deciding that based on how I'm going to organize my messages. Hopefully I'm deciding that based on what I think Paul was thinking as he organized his letter. So that's our agenda over the next few weeks, is to understand that structure. So what I want to concentrate on then is the first section of part one. And that's a fairly large section, so I'm not going to read it in advance. I will dip into it and read certain parts of it as we need to illustrate my point. But it starts off in part three. He talks about how we are all under sin. Even though we know God, we did not honor God or give thanks, but we suppressed that truth. And refusing to acknowledge God, we created idols in our own image and worshiped them. Therefore, God gave us over to degrading passions and to a depraved mind. And he ends that section by saying, you condemn yourself, every one of you, when you pass judgment on another human being, because you rightly recognize how damnable their behavior is, but you're damning yourself because you do the same things that they do. You rightly understand how damnable your own behavior is. That's how he ends that section. And then he begins the next section by saying, so what are you thinking, you guys? Do you think you're going to escape the condemnation that you deserve because you have the wherewithal and the wits about you to be able to look at other people and condemn them for their actions? Do you think that's going to let you off the hook when it comes to God's wrath in the end? And argues in that section, it's the people who pursue goodness who are going to be given life in the final judgment, not those people who know how bad the rest of the world is. It's not, if you're pursuing evil, you will be condemned. If you are pursuing goodness, and only if you are pursuing goodness, will you experience life. Then he raises, in the next section, he raises the question about whether or not there's any favoritism that God shows to the Jews as over against the Gentiles. We'll come back and talk about that in a little bit. He argues in that section that God doesn't show any favoritism to the Jews, which then raises the question for the next section, what advantage is there in being a Jew then? If God doesn't show any favoritism, if they have no, if there's no benefit in their identity as Jews, then what's their benefit in having an identity as a Jew? And he says, well, they have a privileged position. In God's role in history, they're a very privileged people. But just because they are a privileged people does not mean that they are a better people. And if they are not a better people, then when it comes to individual judgment, God gives them no advantage. God shows them no favoritism. And then he ends that section by saying that the very purpose of the covenant is for those who are in and under that covenant to come to realize how morally depraved they are. So that it's not just the Gentiles who are condemned because of their lawlessness, but any Jew who's really taken the covenant seriously realizes that he too stands condemned for his moral depravity. So every mouth is closed and every human being is held accountable. All flesh is accountable to God. Yeah. The Mosaic Covenant. Yep. And then finally, and only then, does he say, apart from the Mosaic Covenant, God has made manifest to those people who believe in Jesus a way in which they will be considered dikaios in God's eyes. Just on an aside here, I'm probably going to use the word dikaios and dikaiosune quite regularly now throughout here. I will eventually define it, but for now, I just understand that what the significance of being dikaios is that you're going to be given eternal life and not condemnation. And the state of being dikaios is dikaiosune. If you attain to dikaiosune, you've attained to a state where you are going to receive life in the final ultimate judgment and not condemnation. Why it means that, we'll get into that later, but that's what I mean whenever I use that language. Okay, that brings us to the end of section one. So the question is, how are we to understand section one? And I'm gonna be brave here and abandon my notes and just see if I can make sense out of this. I hope this works. For most of my life as a Bible teacher teaching the book of Romans, the perspective I've had, because it was taught to me very, very early, that what is he doing here in Romans, in the first section, in the early part of Romans? He's setting out to show us and prove to us that the gospel of Jesus Christ and only the gospel of Jesus Christ can bring salvation. Nothing else can bring salvation. So if you come to believe in Jesus, you will be saved. But if you don't manage to ever come around and believe in Jesus, you can't get there. You're not going to get to life in that way. So what that suggested then, I mean, when you begin to read the passage then as if that's what it's intended to say, that's what its purpose is, it's very puzzling, the first part of Romans, because he talks about Gentiles being dikaios. If they do the things of the law, they will be dikaios, where a Jew who doesn't do the things of the law will not be dikaios. He talks about there's no favoritism shown to the Jews. that they don't have any distinct advantage, which you think, okay, that's right. He's trying to tell them not to deceive themselves when they're Jews into thinking that God is going to let them off the hook and ignore their disobedience and ignore their sin and ignore their transgression just because they're Jews. And you have to get them to know that so that they can come to know that they are just as morally depraved as the Gentiles. And because they're just as morally depraved, there's no way in the world that through their obedience to the law, they're going to be saved. And that after making that, after having made that point, then he can finally come to the finale where he says, so you see, no human being can ever be saved in any other way, by any law, by any covenant, by any deeds that they do. The only way they can be saved is if they come to believe in Jesus. Well, I've always assumed that something like that is what he's trying to do in this first part, because that's what had been taught to me, made sense, and in the light of that, I've always tried to fit it into that. The problem is, over the years, I've begun to dive into those various pieces that make up the early part of Romans, and as you delve into those early pieces, they don't really fit into that picture. And in fact, they actually are in tension with that picture and they contradict that picture. So we have to rethink what's going on in this early part and shed that notion that what he's trying to prove is that we are justified by belief in Jesus and only that, and it's completely and totally apart from the covenant. Because what I'm going to argue is Paul doesn't even believe that. Paul thinks that God can save whomever he saves. In fact, the bottom line for Paul is God gives dikaiosune to anyone with a circumcised heart. Jew, Gentile, pagan, I don't care who you are. If God has invaded your life and the Spirit of God has transformed your heart commitments on the inside, that's what he calls a circumcised heart, has marked you as belonging to him because of the changes in your commitments and your values and your orientation on the inside of you, if God has done that, it's because he has determined to show you mercy and grant you life. And if that hasn't happened, all the religiosity and piety and covenants in the world aren't going to make any difference to God. That there's one and only one criteria for who it is that gets saved. It's the one whose life has been captured by the Spirit of God changing them on the inside. I mean, that's what Paul really actually believes. And we're going to see evidence of that right here in the first part of Romans. But because he believes that, he cannot be arguing in the early part of Romans, there's no way, no how, that anyone under the covenant can find salvation. Because of course they can, if their heart is circumcised. If they are a Jew inwardly and not merely outwardly, he says. So if you are a Jew inwardly, under the covenant, you will be saved under the covenant. If you're a Gentile who has been owned by God inwardly outside of the covenant, well, then I guess you'll be saved outside of the covenant. And that's actually the nature of his argument here in the early part of Romans. But we end up distorting and skewing and misunderstanding what Paul is saying if we have already decided ahead of time that what he has to be saying is there's no way, no how, no when that somebody is ever going to be saved under the covenant, because the covenant can't cut it. And that's not what he's saying. That's the power of our paradigms, the power of our assumptions, that for years and years and years teaching Romans, I would read this section and read this section and read this section and read this section, but it never could overturn my basic understanding of what he had to be saying. But where did that come from? Where did that what he had to be saying come from? It was taught to me in very, very early in my experience as a Christian and as a Bible teacher. It just never occurred to me to rethink it. But as we go through here, I'm going to argue that we do need to rethink that. So let me, if I can go back to my notes now, find them. Let me suggest several ways here in which a different way of understanding this fits the evidence of the passage better than, for lack of a better word, just let me call it the traditional view. The traditional view is the one that he's trying to prove, that we can't be saved by the law, therefore the only way we can be saved is through faith in Jesus. The traditional view sees the structure of it this way. In what I have is part three. Part three, he explains that we are all depraved, morally depraved. In part seven, which will become part eight in the new edition that you get, that in part seven, he explains the gospel and comes to the finale of his argument and argues, therefore, we are justified by faith in Jesus and only by faith in Jesus. And then in between, he's giving you the evidence and the arguments and the perspective that you need to find it compelling that you better believe in Jesus because there's no other way to be saved except by Jesus. And that all that stuff is intended to make that case in between. So that's how we understand the structure in the traditional view. But here are the problems. The traditional view wants to take Paul to be making the point that every human being, both Jew and Gentile, is depraved and therefore is incapable of being saved by the covenant, by the law. But if that's the case, why doesn't Paul stay focused on and emphasize the universality of human depravity? If that's the critical part of his argument, why does he brush by it so quickly? There are two paragraphs in the entire first section that sort of articulate the universality of human depravity, only two paragraphs. Everything else is doing something else. And what I've always done with that is doing something else, yeah, but it must be compatible with exploring the depravity, the universality of human sin and depravity. So I'll figure that out someday. Well, when I got around to figuring it out, I realized there's a real tension there. Why is he not focusing on the thing that the traditional view says he has to be focusing on in order to make the case that the traditional view says he has to be making? There's something wrong there that he doesn't center his whole set of remarks and arguments in the way that the traditional view says that he should. On my view, it makes sense that he mentions universal depravity because one of the things that the Gentiles are going to be up against are Jews coming along and suggesting that you can't be saved and a bona fide disciple of Jesus unless you keep the Mosaic Covenant. As Larry and I were exploring in Galatians a few months ago, I can't remember how long ago it was, maybe it was a long time ago, what Paul is afraid of, what Paul recognizes, is that many of those Jews have a mindset that however much they might deny in theory that keeping the law does anything for you to commend you to God, in practice, they don't believe their own theory, their own theology. In practice, their mindset and their attitude is very much to depend upon and rely upon their law-keeping to commend them to God. So it's going to be part of Paul's point, it's going to be an important part of Paul's point, that no human being can keep the law in any way that in any way contributes to their worthiness in God's eye, in God's eyes. We can't become worthy keeping the law. God really is not much impressed by religiosity and piety. He's really only interested in morality, and morality is the very thing that we are incapable of giving him. We're not good people, we are evil people. We are not righteous people, we are unrighteous people. And every time we attempt to keep the law, it becomes clear how unrighteous we are because I find myself filled with all kinds of desires and longings that are against what is right and good and pure and holy and true. So if I take the law seriously, The law searches me out. It peers into the very depths of my being and reveals what a selfish, godless creep I am. So how would I ever think that through any kind of law keeping, I'm ever going to be able to stand before God and say, I believe in Jesus and I kept the law, and that's 2 points. His whole point is to say that that second point's never going to happen with any human being. So that's part of his argument, but that's not the focus of his argument in section one, I will argue, and hopefully we'll be able to see that. Secondly, the traditional view wants to take Paul to be making the point that because we are saved by believing in Jesus apart from and independently of the covenant, then Jews and Gentiles are on the same footing when it comes to salvation. But on the traditional view, the equal footing of Jew and Gentile is a consequence of the gospel. It's not a reason to believe the gospel. But Paul establishes the equal footing of Jew and Gentile not in relationship to the gospel, but in relation to the covenant. I'll read part of it here, and I'll show you that he's saying before we even get to Jesus, before we even begin to consider Jesus, if all we are considering is the covenant that Moses made with Israel, it's still the case that the Jew and the Gentile are on an equal footing. So why would Paul construct his argument this way if his purpose is what the traditional view proposes, that he's trying to show us that both Jew and Gentile need salvation in Jesus because they are on an equal footing? It's only by convincing us that we need to believe in Jesus that puts us on an equal footing on the traditional view. Let me read part 4, which will become part 5 in the new version. And just think in terms of, we're not to part 7, which will become part 8. We are not to his articulation of the gospel yet. This is earlier than that. 2:3, starting with chapter 2, verse 3. But do you suppose this, O man, you who pass judgment on those who practice such things and do the very same things, that you will escape the judgment of God? Or do you disregard the wealth of his kindness, even of his forbearance and long-suffering, not realizing that the kindness of God is directing you toward repentance? But in accord with your hardness and an unrepentant heart, you are storing up wrath for yourselves in the day of wrath and of the realization of the righteous judgment of God. He will pay back to each according to his deeds. On the one hand, life in the final age is for those who, in accord with their perseverance in doing good acts, seek glory and honor and incorruption. But on the other hand, fury and wrath is for those who, out of selfish ambition, disobey the truth and obey unrighteousness. Tribulation and distress is upon every last person of the man who pursues evil, of the Jew first and foremost, but also of the Greek. But glory, honor, and shalom is to everyone who does what is good, to the Jew first and foremost, but also to the Greek. So far, notice, he's saying when it comes right down to the final criteria that God is going to use, doesn't matter whether you're Jew or Greek, in both cases, he's going to judge you by whether you persevered in doing good or whether you persevered in seeking your own selfish ambition. Then he goes on. Now, there is no favoritism with God. Anyone who sins apart from the covenant will in fact be destroyed apart from the covenant, and anyone who sins within the covenant will be judged in the light of the requirements of the covenant. It is not the hearers of the divine commandments who are dikaios before God. Rather, it is the doers of the divine commandments who will be deemed dikaios. Indeed, when Gentiles who do not have the covenant by natural birthright do the things required by that covenant, even though these people do not possess the covenant for themselves, such things are a covenant. Such people demonstrate the deed required. Such people demonstrate the deed required by that covenant written on their hearts. Accordingly, in the day when God will judge the hidden parts of men, their conscience, by which I mean their reasonings about alternative actions, as they either indict or else defend each alternative, will bear witness for them, according to my account of the good news received through Jesus the Messiah. I'm going to skip down to paragraph 15 that will become 16. So indeed, circumcision has profit if you strive to perform your covenantal obligations. But if you are a transgressor of your covenantal obligations, your circumcision has become as uncircumcision. So indeed, if the uncircumcised man keeps the requirements of the covenant, will not his uncircumcision be considered as circumcision? The man born uncircumcised who completes the requirements of the covenant will indeed condemn you, who, in spite of having the letter of the divine commandments and circumcision, are a transgressor of the covenant. For it is not the one who is so in outward appearance who is a Jew, neither is circumcision what appears outwardly on the body. Rather, a Jew is he who is so in his hidden part, and circumcision is of the heart. It is by the Spirit, not by the letter. His praise is not from men, but from God. The point is, yes, he's putting the Jew and the Gentile on equal footing, but he's putting the Jew and the Gentile on equal footing by a very different criteria than whether they believe in Jesus. The criteria that puts them on the equal footing is when you face the moral demands of law that have been embodied in the Mosaic Covenant, are you interested in pursuing them or are you not interested in pursuing them? If you're a Gentile who's interested in pursuing that vision of godliness that's embodied in the Mosaic Law, what's God going to do? Damn you? No. He's going to consider you dikaios in his eyes and will grant you eternal life. You might as well be a Jew. In terms of the covenant, you might as well be a Jew who has the covenant and is a covenant keeper because you're doing, you're pursuing, you're interested in the moral vision of godliness that's embodied in that Mosaic covenant. And if you're a Jew who has the covenant and prides yourself in the covenant and embraces the covenant and memorizes the covenant, but you're not interested in living your life in a way that you practice and pursue that moral vision of godliness that's embodied in the covenant, is God going to consider you dikaios because you memorized some language? Because you're a champion of the cause of the Mosaic Covenant? No. He's going to condemn you because you're not doing it. You're not pursuing that which the law demands and requires. So by that criteria, he's saying, there really is no significant advantage with respect to an individual being judged by God for the Jew over the Gentile. If a person's heart longs to be obedient to God, then that can happen outside the covenant and it can happen inside the covenant. Doesn't really make any difference. So notice, he has equalized Jew and Gentile before Jesus is even in the picture here. It's totally and completely in the context of how are we to understand what this covenant is all about and what it does and it does not mean. Having the covenant doesn't mean you're okay. And not having the covenant doesn't mean you're damned. It just kind of depends on how you live your life. In the final analysis, if God has invaded your heart and circumcised your heart by his Spirit, then he can do that in the context of Judaism, or he can do that outside the context of Judaism and the covenant and do that in the life of a Gentile. So since that doesn't make any difference, what? See? And what I'm going to argue that he's saying is, then he goes on and tells them the gospel that they already know. The people who are open and receptive and have a circumcised heart, they see and recognize in Jesus the truth of what God has accomplished on their behalf. When they see and recognize that in Jesus, is there any advantage to adding law keeping to that? And what Paul is saying is, if there was no advantage to adding law keeping before Jesus, why would there be advantage to adding law-keeping after Jesus? I don't think you understand law-keeping, he's saying. If you think that there's no way you can be a bona fide disciple of Jesus without becoming a covenant-keeping Jew, living like a covenant-keeping Jew, then you never understood what the covenant was all about to begin with. It didn't help you before Jesus, And it can't help you after Jesus. Because it's not about outward conformity to the covenant. It's always, has always been about the inward reality of the human heart. It's always what it's been, always what it will be, and that's what Jesus tests. Having to confront the claims of Jesus tests what's going on in your heart. Are you open? Are you receptive? Are you owned by God? Has His Spirit invaded your being and given you eyes to see and ears to hear? Then you'll come to Jesus. You'll recognize in Jesus the truth of everything that God is doing in human history. If God has not invaded your heart, has not given you eyes to see and ears to hear, has not circumcised your heart, then you're going to be blind and deaf and hardened and callous to everything that Jesus is and everything He represents. But that's not different. It's the same truth that has always defined a human being's relationship with God. It's just that in these days, with the coming of Jesus, we have a whole new aspect of God's purposes and God's plans to deal with here. And it's a whole new test for what's going on in the human heart. And that's the uniqueness of Jesus. It doesn't redefine how it is that a human being is to kaios in God's eyes. Okay, this is closely related to the last point. The traditional view wants to take Paul to be making the point that one can never be dikaios due to obedience to the covenant, but only by believing in Jesus. Therefore, the traditional view wants to see Paul as dismissing dikaiosune in connection with the covenant, with covenant obedience altogether. If that's the case, then why do we find exactly the opposite throughout these whole opening paragraphs? Instead, we find Paul making clear that it is not mere outward obedience to the covenant that leads to dikaiosune, it is inward spontaneous heart obedience that leads to dikaiosune. But if you understand what I'm saying, he's not dismissing the covenant as an avenue in which someone can find dikaiosune, which is what the traditional view wants to do. He's not dismissing it as an avenue. He's saying, sure, it's always been available to Jews to be dikaios in God's eyes, but only if they're doers of the law and not merely hearers. It's only when one is a doer of the covenant that one is dikaios in God's eyes. The mere hearers of the law, it's of no consequence to God. He doesn't care if you memorized it. He doesn't care if you can apply it to other people and tell them how damnable they are. He doesn't care about any of that. He wants to know if you have a heart that longs to be the kind of person that the covenant describes. That's a doer of the law. So what an odd thing for Paul to be doing if the traditional view is right, because it shoots himself in the foot in his argument. You have to come to Jesus because you can't find salvation in the law. Well, let me tell you how to find salvation in the law here. You got to do it the right way, not the wrong way. Those are in tension with each other. But it makes a whole lot more sense if his purpose is not to dismiss the law, but to dismiss outward conformity to the law as contributing in any way at all to your standing in God's eyes. Because that's what the circumcision party in Galatians is saying. Yes, come to Jesus. Yes, believe that he's the Messiah. Yes, accept the fact that he died for your sins and was raised for the forgiveness of your sins. Yes, believe all that and become circumcised and eat kosher and keep the Sabbath. And why would I do that, sir? Well, because God really wants us to do that. And if you don't outwardly conform to that, you cannot be dikaios in his eyes. And to which Paul is saying, that you really think that contributes to anything? It's the inward heart. If a Gentile without doing any of that, it's always been available to a Gentile without doing any of that to be dikaios in God's eyes, then why on earth does that change after Jesus? Coming to Jesus is quite sufficient. It's quite enough that you don't need anything more. Okay, and then finally, and the thing that's most striking to me, because this is always, I've just always never known what to do with this. The traditional view would expect a finale to this section, you know, an ending, a conclusion to this section that states clearly and explicitly that every human being is rendered to chaos by believing in Jesus and not by their obedience to the covenant. I mean, that's how we teach it. That's the theology we derive from it. So if that's what we teach, if that's the theology that Paul expects us to derive, why doesn't he say that? There'd be no need to make explicit there's no distinction between Jew and Gentile. That would transparently follow. And there would be no need to emphasize that the Jew has no special standing to boast of. That too would be transparent. So why is it that Paul explicitly emphasizes both of those things in the finale to this section? Let me read it, and you'll see what I'm saying. Right, according to the traditional view, the argument is supposed to be, no way, no how can any Jew or any Gentile ever be justified by the law. We can only be justified in Jesus. So before I get on with the rest of my comments, let me make it clear where I'm going. And you'd expect him to be saying, nowhere, no how can any human being be saved by anything other than Jesus, period. Underline, emphasize that. That's the essence of the gospel. But look at what he says. But now apart from the covenant, a dikaiosune from God has been made manifest to all those who believe. I'm sorry, I'm in 3:21 and following. But now apart from the covenant, a dikaiosune from God has been made manifest to all those who believe. A dikaiosune that is attested to by the Torah and the prophets. Even a dikaiosune from God that is connected with believing that Jesus is the Messiah. Now there is no distinction. Indeed, all have sinned and come short of the glory of God, being decreed to chaos as a gift by his grace in view of the redemption which was paid by Messiah Jesus. He is the one whom God put before himself as a propitiatory offering with a view to our believing in his blood. This was for an indication of his righteousness in face of the overlooking of our previously committed sins by the forbearance of God. It was toward an indication of his righteousness in the time here and now, to the end that he might be righteous, even as he is the one who decrees the unrighteous person to chaos by virtue of his belief in Jesus. Where, then, is there any basis for boasting? Through what sort of covenant is it excluded? Through one of achievements? No, rather, through a covenant of belief. Accordingly, we have concluded that a human being is declared to chaos with regard to his belief apart from covenant achievements. Or is God only God in relation to the Jews? Is he not also God in relation to the Gentiles? Yes, also in relation to the Gentiles, if indeed God is one. And then here's the punchline. He will declare the circumcision to chaos by virtue of their belief, and he will declare the uncircumcision to chaos in keeping with their belief. See, that the way he puts that makes all the sense in the world. If the purpose for this whole section, this is the point that he was driving to, is when it comes to believing in Jesus, faith in Jesus is going to make you dikaios in God's eyes, whether you're circumcised or uncircumcised. It doesn't really make any difference. Because the temptation that's going to face the Gentiles when the Jews come back is the Jews are going to say, oh, you're not circumcised? There's no way that you can be a real disciple of Jesus and a real child of God if you're not circumcised. You got to get yourself circumcised and start keeping the Sabbath and start eating kosher. And Paul, where does Paul want to end the section? What does he want his readers to know? No. Faith in Jesus is the basis for you being the chaos in God's eyes, whether you be circumcised or whether you be uncircumcised. It doesn't make any difference. Well, that's a very different conclusion with a very different purpose than the purpose being no way, no how can anyone ever be justified by being circumcised. You can only find salvation through faith in Jesus, so don't you be looking for salvation through circumcision. Well, he just said you can be circumcised. That's fine. You can be circumcised or not circumcised. It's neither here nor there. The key is, do you or do you not believe the truth about Jesus? Okay. Questions, comments?
Thanks, Jack. That was great. So I just want to clarify what I think I hear you saying, and about it seems that you make a difference between keeping the law and doing the law.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And keeping the law would be being circumcised, eating kosher, keeping the Sabbath. And doing the law would be someone who wants to do the good, to be a good person, in essence. Is that?
Well, no, not exactly. Okay. And in fact, parroting Paul's language, there's a crucial distinction that we need to make. But you can't find one set of words that yeah. Paul always uses to make that distinction.
That was part of my question, because in that section that you read, he seemed to be emphasizing doing. That a person needs to do the law.
Right, right.
And I was going to ask you, I mean, in the Greek, is there a different word? Does he use a word that's more like do instead of keep? Because that can be very confusing, because
it sounds
like he's saying you need to keep the law, and you're saying, well, wait a second, he doesn't need to keep the law.
Yeah.
So that's why I figured you must be making some distinction between doing and keeping.
Yeah, there's a crucial distinction to be made, but you won't find any language that he uses to keep it nice and tidy. He'll call it do, he'll call it keep, he'll call it guard, he'll call it anything and everything, he'll call it that. The distinction he's making is between doing the law and doing the law. Okay? There's two different ways to do the law. You can do the law by successfully having everything that you say, do, and think conform to what God requires of you. That would be one way of doing the law. In that sense of the doing the law, Paul is going to say, there ain't no human being on earth who ever does the law.
That would include keeping the Sabbath and eating kosher.
Well, no, I mean, maybe you can find somebody who's kept every cotton picking Sabbath. I mean,
well, but you do that and all the rest of the doing. It would include that you couldn't, that's
yeah.
impossible.
Yeah, the Jews aren't going to really make a significant distinction between the moral demands of the law and the ritualistic demands of the law. They're all part of the covenant. God commanded them. God expects us to do them, so we should do them. So I not only need to be a Sabbath keeper and eating kosher, but I need to love my neighbors, myself, and all this other stuff that's a part of the, I shouldn't murder, steal, commit adultery, and so on. That's all part of the covenant, and I must do it. Well, can I do what God has asked me to do in its entirety in the covenant if what do means is conform my every thought, action, and so on to what it demands? No, because we are given over to degrading passions and a depraved mind. Of course I can't. But there's a different sense of doing that is actually more often what Paul or the other apostles mean than that. The other sense of doing is strive to perform it because from the inside I'm captivated by what a worthy thing that would be to do, and so I'm going for it. So I'm striving to live my life to not be a thief, a murderer, adulterer, a hater, an obnoxious, self-centered person, selfishly ambitious, prideful, and so on. I recognize how right and good it would be for me to have my life conform to that, so I'm going for it. I'm doing it. Do you see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
I'm taking it on as my existentially self-defining life project to be and do everything I can to become that kind of person. Well, I'm obviously going to fail in that effort. I'm going to find myself not doing the very thing that I want to do. Ring a bell?
Right.
I'm going to find myself The very thing I don't want to do, that's what I do. The thing I want to do, I don't do. I'm going to find that that's my experience. But the reason I'm finding that that's my experience is because I've taken it on. I want to be good. I want my life to be characterized by that. Well, Paul at various times is going to call that doing the law. Well, that's what he means in this early section of Romans. It's not the hearers of the law who are just before God. It's the doers of the law.
Right.
They've taken it on, and they are pursuing it.
That can be really easily construed for, it's not the hearers of the law, it's the keepers of the law. It's the good Jews who are doing all this, every straining out a gnat.
Right
stuff,
and that's what's
but it's
within
not what
the within the Reformed tradition. They have taken that doing the law as literally successfully being good in every sense, and so you'll often hear in the Reformed tradition, you can't be saved by the law unless you completely and totally do, that is, succeed in having your life meet the requirements of the law in every last jot and tittle of what the law requires. That's why everybody is depraved.
And nobody can do that, and that's why we need Jesus in
right.
a different paradigm
right.
of the gospel, yeah.
But I'm looking at that very differently.
Right.
He's saying, no, you can be a doer of the law. You always could be a doer of the law. In fact, there are Gentiles out there that can be the doer of the law, and they don't even have the law.
Right.
If they are the kind of people who have been captivated by the vision of what it would be to be like their Creator morally, and they're going for it. They want their life to conform to that. Will they succeed? No, of course not. They're depraved. Of course they won't succeed. But is their effort in that regard an earnest, sincere definition of their heart, defining characteristic of their heart? Absolutely. Well, those are the people who are dikaios.
So as you read, you have to use context then to discern what Paul means when he says do the law.
Okay. Absolutely. Yeah.
Are you saying then that if we're earnest in pursuing this spirit of the covenant, that the earnestness that we can do that without Jesus? Or are you implying that?
Yes.
Okay.
I am implying that.
How does our spirit get captivated with this desire? Can it be apart from Jesus?
Well, okay, now it depends what you mean, apart from Jesus. Can it be apart from having confronted the truth about Jesus, having been faced with the truth of Jesus? Yes. Abraham is exhibit A. That he's the father of your and my faith. He had our faith before we did. And he was never tested by whether or not he believed that Jesus was the Messiah. That was never a part of what tested his inwardness, his inner core commitments. Because he lived at a different time in history. Would Abraham be the father of our faith if God had stuck Jesus in front of him and said, okay, what are you going to do with him? And Abraham had said, nothing. I don't like him. I reject him. He's not going to be my king. If Abraham could have done that, then no. There's no salvation apart from Jesus. As the way Jesus puts it is, everyone who knows the Father comes to the Son. Anyone who rejects the Son does not know the Father.
Right.
So as ultimately and absolutely an objective test of whether or not that, to use your word, earnestness is there, no, you can't come to God apart from Jesus. But can God save you apart from ever even seeing whether or not you would come to Jesus, and whether without you ever seeing whether you would come to Jesus? Sure.
So you're sort of arguing that they fit this, the desire for the goodness as illustrated by God in Christ, or perhaps without him, I'm not sure, but that they fit,
Yeah.
One sort of assumes or makes sense of the other and vice versa.
Exactly.
To some degree.
And that will make more and more sense the more we dive into the details of his argument and his theology. That will make more and more sense. But yeah, in general, that's exactly what I'm saying, is that from Paul's perspective, what Jesus does is the latest, the greatest, and the final test of the inwardness of a human being. If you are rightly oriented to God in your insides, you will acknowledge Jesus for what he actually is in God's scheme of things. If you reject who Jesus is ultimately in God's scheme of things, then what's going on in your insides, Paul would say. And if in fact what's going on in your insides is a kind of deafness to the message of God, a blindness to the truth of what God is doing, where is that coming from except a person who's not being sanctified by the Spirit of God? So belief in Jesus is kind of the ultimate test of that, but it's not the only test. And nothing in Paul will ever say, unless you have been tested by that, you cannot be saved. No, that's kind of up to God, to what he'll decide whether he's going to save you without having tested so that you can see your openness by your receptivity of Jesus. That's God's business, not our business.
If I can attach another question onto this.
Okay.
It's about the way, I think it's about the way people talk about total depravity, in the sense that lines such as, and I can't remember what line you actually used earlier, but lines such as, we have no good in us, we are totally depraved, we are just sinners, or that kind of thing, that say there is no good. And I struggle with that, because I say, in my understanding, and I'm either a heretic or I would love us to speak about this differently, that there is lots of good in us. It's not enough to work out salvation. So none of us is good enough to be saved, but it doesn't mean that we're totally bad and totally depraved. By the grace of God, there's lots of good in us and enough good for Jesus to consider us worthy to die for. Mm-hmm. I'd love your comment on that.
Okay. This will make more sense when we dive into the details, but yet we are given over to depraved mind, Paul is going to say. So we're prisoners of it, we're enslaved to a depraved mind. And I think that's what people are trying to say by total depravity. It should be what they're trying to say by that. But you're right. We often take that further as if that means there is no redeeming value in my being as a being. And that's simply completely unbiblical. Because from the get-go, we recognize in Genesis 1, we are creatures created in the image of God. And that alone gives us incredible dignity, incredible goodness. We are incredibly glorious beings because we were created that way. And that's the tragedy of human sin, is that it's a glorious being who is worthy of destruction because of our rebellion. We're not destroyed because we're worthless. We're destroyed because we're very worthy beings who have rebelled against our Creator. That's an entirely different matter. We are morally worthless, not ontologically worthless. It's not my being that is worthless. It's my rebelliousness that has rendered me morally damnable. So, yeah, that's a good point.
Thank you. Thank you.
One more, and then we better...
Jack, I've heard you talk about the Jews and how you think that God still hasn't finished working out his promises for them. I'm just wondering if you could clarify concerning, I can't think of specifics right now, but he often uses the language, I feel, in Romans of, like, I think you said, like, they might as well be Jews because... But is that only regarding, like, how God is going to deal with people eternally?
Yes. And
could you comment on that?
Yes, exactly. Because that's his only interest in the early part of Romans. When we get later in Romans, where he's going to talk about Jew and Gentile again, then his interest is the unique and privileged role that the people of God, the Jews, the people of God have in history. And what he will be arguing there is, everything I've said about how the Jews have no advantage when it comes to justification, dikaiosune, everything I said about that doesn't negate the privileged position they have in human history. They're a very remarkably unique people that God has chosen for himself. Okay, thank you for being patient. We'll just continue this next week.